Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. Coming up on 13 minutes after 9 o'clock on a Tuesday, Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. It's the panel. And the panel today, oh, it's a good one. Mike Spain is here from the Times Union. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Ray.
It's 2 days in a row, yeah?
Yeah, well, that's about it.
I think we've hit our our Spain quota here. So let's just,
yeah, we're covered.
Let's call it a day after this. Judy Patrick from the Daily Gazette. Judy, nice to have you.
It is nice to be here, Ray.
So it's your first time in the redone Studio A, huh?
Yeah, it's a little egg carton-y.
It is indeed.
And Alan Shartok, the man who signed off on the egg carton motif, is here as well. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. So you're blaming me now?
No, I like it. Well, you know, you look at it and you say egg cartony.
Yeah.
Which is a fine word, by the way.
Very I'm an editor.
Not cheap, this acoustic foam.
No, very not cheap, eh?
Very not cheap. Adventures in English here on the round. Let's just start again, for God's sake. Yeah, that's expensive foam. It's reticulated. It's reticulated foam.
Reticulated.
And so
our voice does not bounce around. There's no echoes, are there?
No. Yeah. No. And the thing is, you mentioned egg cartons, and you can, in a pinch, use egg cartons to do the same thing. No kidding. It's the shape.
For a low-budget, like, college radio station or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Or one of the commercial stations nowadays.
That's true.
I'm sure. Anyway, the email address here, if you want to complain about our syntax and our grammar, it's roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. And we'll start it off here. The University of Missouri system plans to begin several initiatives over the next 3 months that it says are aimed at improving the racial atmosphere on its four campuses and cultivating diversity and inclusion. Yesterday, the president of the university system, Tom Wolf, resigned following protests by students who said he was unresponsive to racial slurs and other incidents. The chancellor of the Columbia campus says he'll step down at the end of the year as well. The student government president at the University of Missouri is calling new initiatives that aim to address the issues a step in the right direction. The Missouri Students Association president, Peyton Head, said he had been hoping for change and was glad to see the ideas put forward yesterday by the four-campus system's governing body. The system said it will appoint its first chief officer for diversity, inclusion, and equity, and it pledged to work toward a more diverse faculty and staff, among other things. The University of Missouri football team is resuming its regular activities following the resignation of the president. Okay, who goes first?
Well, is the football team really showed a little bit of courage. Their coach showed a lot of courage because, after all, he worked for the and he supported the football players in calling for the resignation of the top people, and they won. Now, that raises a secondary question, which is if the football program, which brings in millions to the university, becomes so important that it, you know, somebody has to leave when they call for that, then what if happens later on if when things are not quite as clear cut as to what's good for the university and demands are made? Is this an unhealthy precedent?
Yeah, I thought it was sad that there's some poor guy on a hunger strike, but it's not until the football team says, no, we're not going to play, that they actually take action.
Yeah.
Well, they would have lost $1 million had they not played their game this week. And so I assume once the football team was involved, the end game had already been played. The president was going to go.
But, I mean, you're just demonstrating that economic pressure has a lot more than political pressure or hunger strikes or protests, because students have been protesting for months now over a variety of incidents that they say the administration was turning a blind eye to. There's been racial epithets. There's been people, who have been discriminated against openly on the campus, and they were unhappy with the way the administration had responded to that. What I thought was interesting is that this guy that stepped down yesterday came from the corporate world with a mandate to cut. And, you know, universities everywhere are facing major economic strife, and they are going to have to tighten the belts, and that's never popular. Now, was it because this guy was not responsive to the complaints about injustice and not responsive to the students who said they were discriminated against, or was it an economic thing, which is really what happened when the football team made that threat? You know, you really wonder which one it was. It was a combination of both, of course, but I wonder which one had the most influence here.
I mean, if somebody takes feces and does a swastika or says some anti-black discriminatory thing, and you're the president or the chancellor of the university, then you're not responsible for somebody having done something really stupid and terribly bad. But then it always becomes, what did you do to react to it? I mean, how...
What is appropriate?
Would you say?
What is appropriate when something outrageous like that happens?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I think this is a tough thing for a college president or chancellor to go through. Because, you know, as soon as it happens, you got to be out there yelling and screaming, this is a terrible thing, which it is. And if you don't yell loud enough, somebody's going to say to you, you have to leave.
You know, it's easy for us to sit in Albany and say, oh, the University of Missouri, what a terrible place, what, you know, bias. But, you know, these kind of problems are all over. And it's a kind of story that makes us think about everything we say and do. And, you know, when you hear a joke, do you, you know, speak up and say, you know, that's not appropriate, that's racist? And, you know, some of the things that are that happened there are things that happen around here too. Maybe not with the intensity that they're happening in Missouri, but it's not an isolated case.
You're quite right.
Well, it does really define the role of leadership in an institution like this, that when something does happen, that it is up to them to immediately take the lead and do everything you can to, you know, express outrage and take whatever steps are necessary to promote healing and to put down this kind of behavior on campus. But it's all, I bet the guy wasn't very popular aside from all that, and,
right.
and that's major. I'm not trying to diminish the, you know, the way that he was lax on enforcing justice and civil rights on campus, but he probably had a whole other area that he had really ticked off because of economic cuts.
Right. I think the English department had a vote of no confidence, and they mentioned other things besides this particular.
Well, that
problem.
Of course happens all the time. You know,
right. So the combination of the two eroded his support. It was. You know,
here in New York State, things have gotten very interesting at SUNY. Our governor has made it clear that he has his thumb on SUNY. He hired a fine, SUNY chancellor, and Carl McCall, who not chancellor, the chair of the board of trustees, and Carl McCall. But if I'm a college president at SUNY now, Plattsburgh, for example, we've just seen this outbreak. I would be very careful about what would be consistent with this governor's positions on things. We saw George Pataki, I mentioned this the other day, basically fire a president down at SUNY New Paltz because he had put on a sex conference. That was his thing. I have a feeling that if I'm a college president in the SUNY system right now, and I know of the relationship between the SUNY chancellor and the governor, I'm very careful about this.
The email address here is roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. It's the Roundtable panel. Mike Spain, Judy Patrick, Alan Chartok, Ray Graff here in for Joe Donahue. We'll take a break. We'll be back.
Support comes from Mount St. Mary College, Newburgh, offering a liberal arts education and career preparation in social services and communications. Admissions open house Sunday, November 15th at 9:30, msmc.edu. Green Conscience Home and Garden, Saratoga Springs, New York, a green design showroom dedicated to healthy interiors with non-toxic flooring, wall finishes, beds, and more. green-conscience.com. Audiologic Solutions, East Greenbush and Hudson, offering treatment for baby boomers experiencing hearing loss, including the Lyric Invisible Hearing Device, audiologicsolutions.org. And Davidson Brothers Brew Pub, featuring food, ales, entertainment, and more, serving lunch and dinner 7 days a week in downtown Glens Falls, New York, davidsonbrothers.com.
Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC, and it is a Tuesday morning, 9:22. Ray here for Joe, Alan, Mike, and Judy on the panel. The email address is roundtable@wamc.org. And Alan, there are some
couple letters,
messages to read.
There are. We've heard from John. Re-Missouri football makes the difference, just like no one cared about the pro football referee strike until it threatened the profits of the team owners. Then suddenly it was settled. And Michael says John Brown on the gallows before the American Civil War addressed the scourge of slavery, saying, quote, as long as slavery exists in this country, that's how long you will pay for this atrocity. And here we are 150 years later, still paying with another 250 years to go. And Joseph says, obviously, athletes have great political power and can affect change all over the country. In particular, voting rights in those states that have created laws to obstruct voting could become a focus for these young adults. And that's from Joe.
Well, I highly doubt that the Missouri football team would say we're not going to play our games unless the state legislature changes voting laws. I mean, this directly affected a lot of the guys on that team. And the power of that team was, in fact, part of the power was it cost the university $1 million a week that they're not playing.
Well, my friend, you never know.
You know, there's probably a good story there about how the football team decided to come together and do something. There probably were a couple of instrumental guys who had an idea, and they maybe a movie someday. Sounds really interesting.
And how they brought about this change. Part of this, too, is the location. In Missouri, they've been very much influenced by the news in the last 16 months about Ferguson, Missouri.
Yep.
And it brings to the forefront the whole discussion of racial injustice and tolerance and how necessary it is to nip it at the bud, so to speak. So I think that did fuel a lot of the protests on the campus. Many have made that observation.
Letter. Mizzou's blind eye and deaf ear to minority concerns magically, in quotes, cured when the purse strings are tugged. Threatened with the NCAA rules requiring a forfeiting team to pay their opponents, suddenly the can see green and hear the cha-ching of the cash register. It's a miracle, I tells you.
Perhaps a little cynical, but I think right on.
and Michael says, the Mizzou resignation is not as much about money as Alan states from the Washington Post. And then there's a long place that we should go to read the
Washington
Post.
Okay, a link. We try not to send links. It's tough for Alan to read an actual link, URL.
We're not going
to
do it.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't do it during a live show.
No,
if you had a couple hours to prepare, then fine.
And this one's pretty long.
Yeah. So let's not do that.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else?
Yeah, he says, also, isn't Plattsburgh a heck of a lot closer than Missouri?
It is. We all know that.
Okay.
I've gone up there several times. You know, we have a major station up there, and I've gone up there, and I got to tell you, it's a long way off.
It's cold up there, too.
I know. I hate to pay his driver double time. It was awful. Federal appeals court has ruled against President Obama's plan to protect an estimated $5 million people living in the United States illegally from deportation. In a 2-1 decision Monday, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a Texas-based federal judge's injunction blocking the administration's immigration initiative. Republicans had criticized the plan as an illegal executive overreach when Obama announced it last November. 26 states challenged the plan in court. The administration argued that the executive branch was within its rights in deciding to defer deportation of selected groups of immigrants, including children who were brought to the U.S. illegally. Texas Governor Greg Abbott praised the ruling. Panel.
Well, you can see this in a number of ways. One is you can see this as a substantive legal question. Did the president expand his powers in order to do this? And there, the Republican majorities on these courts have made it clear that he did. He went too far. They're going to go to the Republican Supreme Court of the United States. Yes, I said that, the Republican Supreme Court of the United States. And they're going to say the same thing, probably. That's why we have a Congress. The Congress is supposed to make these rules, and the Congress has tried and couldn't do it. And so the president comes out and does it. Now, my sympathies, of course, are with the president. But if you analyze this on a political level, then the president makes out like a bandit because it would appear, that he tried. He tried. We had 11 million, 12 million, 30 million people in this country who are undocumented, and they are being exploited, and they're being terribly fearful about their children and everything else. The president wants to do something. The president's going to get their votes, and his party's going to get their votes.
So, on a practical level, doesn't this just kill the plan? There's no way it will get what will happen until Obama leaves office, and then it's not going
to
happen.
There's not enough time for it to go and be resolved by the Supreme Court, is what you're saying.
To both of you, maybe they may see it on an expedited basis, mm-hmm. but to both of you, it's not going to happen because the Congress is not going to do it. They say, we don't want to do it, and we don't want you to do it either.
Well, isn't that really why the president took this action? Because Congress has done nothing to resolve the immigration crisis. But, and really what they're doing, I mean, their argument, I think, has merit, that they have limited resources. Are you going to go after the elderly parents and the children, or are you going to go after the people with criminal records, the risky people? And if they are going to focus on a particular group out of that 11 million who are undocumented immigrants, I think I would rather see them go after the others first. And when they resolve that problem, then we can talk about what to do with the parents and the children.
This really isn't about the merits of any plan. This is about whether the president can just overreach Congress and impose a plan. And I think that's a much bigger issue in the long run.
Now, if we can all just suspend our feelings about one party or the other, and just then look at this as something that we will all be studying in constitutional law class in, 40 years from now. Did the president overstep his authority? Is this something that should have been decided by Congress? It could have been decided by Congress and wasn't, and he gets slapped on the hand. When President Roosevelt, although he did go to Congress to do it, did his court-packing plan, he got slapped on the hand.
We're about out of time, but we can pick this up on the other side of the news. The email address is roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC, 9:33 on a Tuesday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe. We have Mike Spain here from the Times Union, Judy Patrick from the Daily Gazette, and Alan Shartok, who is kind of a big deal around here at WAMC. The email address is roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. Now, we have editors of two papers, competing papers, sitting next to each other, and they have not once punched each other today, which was great. Judy and Mike, you've been really well behaved.
No, we did a coming in.
You did?
We like to keep it outside the building.
Yeah. It's really good. And so I thought we would just take a Alan?
I just wanted to jump in on that one and tell you the problem with these two is that they happen to be the two nicest people in the world.
They're very nice.
So they don't punch each other. They're not like that.
Well, we've got to get them liquored up
you
before the show.
You and I, on the other hand. That's another whole story.
Hey, you and I.
Let's have a brawl.
Yeah, that's right. Steel cage death match here in studio. Away. All right, so without playing favorites, let's find out what's happening in the newspapers. We'll go with Mike first, since he is clearly the senior of the two.
Thank you for that, Ray. It happens to be true. I think the story that people are talking about today is the news that the tolls on the New York State Thruway are not going to go up in 2016.
Hooray.
But that's just a piece of the story, of course. What they're doing is putting together a panel to study the issue of tolls on the Thruway. In fact, Jerry Jennings, the former mayor of Albany, is one of the people who've been appointed to this this advisory board that is going to help the State Thruway Authority figure out their future. And of course,
the panel being paid?
I don't believe so. I think that it's public service.
All right.
And they're going to come out with a report next year. But the big elephant in the room, of course, is the replacement bridge for the Tappan Zee connecting Rockland and Westchester County. That's a $4 billion project, and there really isn't a clear way that's set so far to pay for it. Obviously, they're getting a low interest loan from the federal government that they have to pay back, and they'll pay it back over years with the revenues that tolls raise. But there's going to still have to be another plan to come up with the money, and to do it without raising the tolls is going to be challenging. What a lot of people are speculating is if you just simply took the cost of the bridge and you raise the toll across the bridge, which I think is like if you're a commuter and you have an easy pass, like about $5.
I think it's $5.
Yeah. It would go up to something like $15
or
more.
I'd rather swim.
And yeah, exactly. Some people, then people would probably go north to the Bear Mountain Bridge, which is just a couple bucks, and that would change the whole traffic patterns. So, and people successively would find alternate ways around. So they are talking about perhaps an adjustment in tolls everywhere. People in Cheektowaga who are going over to Buffalo might actually see a slight increase so the Thruway Authority could pay this off. That's the fear. And it's going to be difficult. A lot of people say they should pay for it with a big chunk of the settlement that New York State got from Wall Street, basically.
Well, that'd be nice.
Big lawsuits. They have like $6 billion before spending it all, and they're using some of this to keep operations.
Here's my question. I took my son down to a ball game in September, and we went over the bridge, and you could see the new construction going on.
Sure.
So how can they start and continue construction if they don't know how to pay for it yet?
Well, that's exactly what's going on. They have a loan. They have a 1.9.
Put on the credit card.
Yeah, well, essentially. That's right. That's exactly what's going on. And so they're paying as they go, and the piper is going to need to be paid.
Yeah.
And they're going to float bonds, and perhaps they'll get a big chunk of this money, but it hasn't really been determined yet.
Well, wasn't it Daddy Cuomo who said we're going to abolish the tolls?
Well, actually, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, when he was the U.S. Senator for New York, came up with a plan in the late 80s that by the early 90s, all the bonds that were floated to pay for the thruway would be paid off, and the and once they stopped charging tolls, they'd be eligible for all kinds of federal aid that they cannot get now for the thruway. And actually, Governor Cuomo realized something that other politicians have realized, that the Thruway Authority was a cash cow. And if they get rid of the tolls, it's going to be difficult to, sort of churn that cow butter, whatever.
Difficult to overspend if you don't have a cash
cow.
Right.
So the Thruway Authority bought the New England Thruway, which was an on-toll road, and Route 84 is now owned by the Thruway, and now the Canal Corporation.
Yeah, Canal. Sure.
And some truckers have a federal lawsuit underway saying that why should interstate truckers be paying for a recreational, primarily a recreational project now, that's the canal, and that, so that could come back and haunt them.
Yeah.
And so it's a bit of a mess, you know.
As a bit of history, can I just add one little thing, and that was when the George Washington Bridge was built and the toll went on that, same deal. They said in so many years it will be paid off and it will be a free bridge. Guess what? It isn't.
No, it is not. What is it now? About 11?
It's a lot of money.
Yes.
That's all I know.
To go one way. Yeah, then you come out the other way free. Yeah.
You know, one of the more interesting things for me about the thruway nowadays is I do Easy Pass, and so many people do Easy Pass, so I don't even know what
you don't even know what you're paying.
And so the government has kind of pulled a fast one on me.
And it's attached to your credit card, so you don't really see it.
Yeah. It's automatically, they take it out automatically.
Yeah, $25 every month or so, and I never look at the details.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those people lining up for Easy Pass, you know, none of them know.
See, I used to go over the bridge coming north and south into Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
That bridge was 10 cents for a long, long, long time.
Is that the Willis Avenue Bridge?
Avenue Bridge is free.
It's still free. Yeah.
This is the Henry Hudson Bridge.
Oh, over on the
west side. And I have to tell you, Judy's exactly right. Yeah. I have no idea how much that thing was. Not only that, but now you don't even have to stop at the Easy Pass. They have automatic.
If you're not an Easy Pass holder,
they still send you a letter.
Guilty. This happened to me. Now we don't have Easy Pass, and I haven't been down to Woodbury or the big tolls down. What is it? Woodbury. I haven't been down there five, six years.
Right. That whole interchange now is automatic.
So my son and I go down to the Mets game. All of a sudden, I'm on 287, and I said, well, geez, I never went through the – I still got the ticket. There's a problem here. You have to go off to the side if you're paying.
The few toll ticket holders have to go off to the side.
Might have been going a little too fast and didn't see the sign, but they did send me a letter.
Yeah. Well, Ray,
what did the letter say?
Said, you owe us $25 for a $6 toll, so I had to pay.
Why? Oh, because you I
don't have Easy Pass.
I know why.
It sort of hits you from the longest distance.
That's right.
Yeah.
I've actually had to do that too, Ray. I don't want you to feel badly. I don't know where it fell out, but somewhere it fell out.
Well, I'd say, Ray, that the right methodology is to go down the Taconic and go 684
down the Hutch.
And down
the Taconic.
Yep. Hutch, yes.
The
Taconic
Hutch.
State Parkway, which is free and a beautiful ride.
Yeah.
If the weather's
one of the
nice.
Most dangerous roads that I have.
Well,
I mean, you know
if you get off at 84 and go west or go east, you miss that really
bad
part.
And remember, there's
the
all that rock on both sides, and we call this the Avenue of Death.
Well, I think we've reached a new low on the roundtable. We're talking about traffic patterns.
So. But there'll be no tolls on the Avenue of Death.
So that's in the Times Union, eh? Let's see what's in the Gazette. Okay. Judy Patrick is the editor of the Gazette. What's happening there?
So we got a story this morning about the effort, once again, it's that time of year for education advocates to start lobbying for increased state funding in the state budget. Next year, people are saying the state needs to spend another $2.2 billion next year to fully fund education. You know, it comes up every year, and we get the debate over foundation aid, over whether or not upstate schools are getting the appropriate amount of funding, whether Long Island schools are overcompensated, what is the best way to do this, property taxes. And you know, education advocates say, you know, the state really needs to take a hard look at it. I don't know if this is ever going to get resolved.
Well, remember the lawsuit a few years ago where the New York City area schools won a settlement that said the state was underfunding education and they needed to correct it. And then along came the recession, you know, the great recession, and they delayed that. And they're debating whether they've even fulfilled that requirement, and that excluded upstate. So, you know, it's pretty much been established that the state is not funding education and that property taxes are enormously burdensome and are not doing the job. And then when you have a state-imposed property tax cap, you know, it's a formula for marginal school districts to face disaster.
I mean, isn't in theory the tax cap supposed to be something that will get easier to deal with as school districts and communities sort of get with the program?
Ask that to local school administrators and local city managers and mayors, et cetera. It's a tough adjustment. And you know, the flip side of it, though, is that there are people saying, $2.2 billion, what, are you crazy? Why, we're already spending too much money on education, and there's no, the results are not there to justify it. And that's a very popular rhetoric that anchors people.
Well, maybe I was the only one up early this morning.
I'm sure. Well, you're the only person up at 1:30, that's for certain.
No, we're talking about 3 o'clock in the car. Okay. 3 o'clock in the car.
And I think that's at night. That's not morning.
That's right.
I'm listening to the BBC.
Okay.
And they're doing this show, which was so fascinating, I can't even believe it, which is they have the world's greatest expert on genetic intelligence. In other words, that no matter what the schools, this is what the guy was saying, no matter what the schools do, it's the genes that you were born in.
Oh, no.
With.
Ooh. My kids are in major trouble.
Oh, dear. No. I can remember when a local school superintendent was questioned after was interviewed after they won some Blue Ribbon Award for their district. It was one just immediately south of Albany, not naming names here.
Okay.
And he said, it's because we have good genes, and boy, they came down on
them. No. It's politically unpopular.
Yes, indeed.
The point that this guy was making again and again, and he is the scientist who knows more about this than anybody in the world, is it's politically unpopular, but it happens to be true. And if you are born with a particular genetic whatever, you're gonna do better. You're gonna learn better than if you don't have that genetic pattern. Now
there's a big range, though. I mean, there's obviously people with predestined ability to be. You know, Einstein.
Is Alan arguing this? No, I'm not arguing for it. I'm just reporting to you what was on the BBC this morning.
Interesting.
It is interesting, but there's so, I mean, for the bulk of the world, there is so much that depends on good teaching, good parenting, having a healthy lifestyle, getting enough time so they can do their work, getting enough sleep, getting enough money so they have good teachers. I mean, dealing with all the handicaps that kids come in, disabilities that kids come into school nowadays, tremendous amount of money spent on that. Yeah, I would check
out. Right, I agree with you, Judy.
Well, no, yeah, I mean, look at it this way. $2.2 billion spent on education is going to be $6 billion not spent on policing and correctional services down the road. I mean, it's
do you have statistics and can you back that up with any sort of a fact?
Perhaps I was just using
editorials. But,
okay, fair enough. He does write editorials. You know what? Let's take a break here. I've had
about
half
of
the rhetoric.
We got a lot of letters.
It's Judy Patrick and Mike Spain from those papers, and Alan Shartok, who does what he does. We'll take a break.
Support comes from MPAC, presenting Thinging, a multidisciplinary conversation between dancer Silas Reiner and poet Ann Carson tomorrow, and a performance of new material by electronic composer Tim Heckler on November 13th. MPAC.rpi.edu. Colby Attorney Service, Corporate Formations, Document Retrieval Services, Court Filings, and Legal Publishing for the legal and professional community since 1939. ColbyService.com. Springbrook, Oneonta, New York, supporting people of all ages with developmental disabilities, thanking the families, friends, and neighbors who assist their over 850 clients, springbrookny.org. And Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham, providing career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, careersintransitionllc.com.
Hello again, boys and girls. It's the roundtable panel. I'm desperately trying to start a fight here, and everybody's in a darn good mood. It's really making me sick. Ray Graff in for Joe
it's
Donahue.
It's the boring agreement among
the
panelists.
The nice people are on the show, except for Alan. Mike Spain and Judy are here, and Alan is just being Alan, and you're trying as well to stir it up, and it's not working out too well. Anybody in the listening audience emailing us?
Oh, yes, they are. Lisa wants to know, hello, rounders.
Oh, hello.
Rosemary would have cut the traffic conversation off much sooner. Sounds like my uncle's Thanksgiving table talk.
What? I agree.
What? You took the hutch? Touché. What, are you crazy? Says Uncle Archie.
Oh, man. You know, this time of year, the hutch
is not agree more. Could not agree more. We reached a new low.
Okay, then W says, Easy Pass. You should check your Easy Pass statements. I crossed the Rip Van Winkle Bridge once. My account was automatically activated to a monthly commuter rate. I only discovered this after about 10 months. When I contacted Easy Pass, I was only credited for 3 months. No. Well, let me say, you're right. We should check it. They send it to you online. But I long ago forgot my password. And then I tried to find my password and get them to give it to me again, and it's impossible.
Huh.
It's just impossible. Well, at least for a 74-year-old it is. Hey, Ray, says Michael.
Yes.
Could you please tell me why you don't have Easy Pass?
Oh, easy. I don't drive.
When I pass those long lines at the cash windows, I can't understand why anyone would not have Easy Pass.
Because the furthest I go on the thruway most of the time is to exit 24, and that's only rarely. And I have not gone south on the thruway that far in 10 years.
Steven says, I get an email alert from Easy Pass each month when urging me to review my statement, which I often do. It's very easy to do, assuming you know your password.
Assuming you know your password.
Just a single click right from the email and a 4-digit PIN. Uh-huh.
Well, why don't you reset the PIN?
Uh-huh. Well,
Alan, there's a little link right on the Easy Pass.
Forgot your
thing.
Password?
Forgot password? Question mark, and it's easy to.
It should say forgot password, comma Alan.
I think I did that.
I'm just saying it would be a lot. The toll would be a lot more painful if I had to fork over a few dollar bills. Just
absolutely.
Flying through there, I'm thinking this road's free.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
I'd take Central Avenue a whole lot more if I had to. Pull it out of my wallet.
In the old days, all these roads, I mean, New Scotland Road had tolls on it, and maybe we should go back to that.
Yeah. The toll house.
Then we could just pay for
That's
everything.
Right. The toll
right?
house over on New Scotland. That was a
Cookies.
Toll house.
We'll get rid of it in a couple of hundred years. It'll be fine.
You know, at one point, Republicans were suggesting that the best way to speed traffic congestion would be, you know, to pay extra to go in the fast lane. You know, to have these higher priced roads, and then rich people would be able to get places fast and the slow people.
They have it around Washington, D.C., right? Yeah. What do they call it? There's a name for it.
Well, there's the HOV lanes over
there. HOV lanes, right. You've got to have a couple
nobody's
people
in
the car. But they're separate, whole separate systems that you get told, and their Easy Pass will bill you a little more if you want to go on the faster.
Can we get a AAA as an underwriter? That would be really terrific. That would be for the next segment. Hey, moving on.
Still, how will they pay for the bridge?
Okay. G says, good morning. While talking about what the court ruled in stopping Obama's immigration action, you must remember that the Constitution clearly designates Congress, not the executive branch, as having the authority to set rules for allowing immigration. Okay, and then there's more, but
you've had enough?
No, but that's basically what's the gist of the thing.
So we should, you know, when you write your emails, do it like you're writing a news copy. So the most important details are in the first paragraph.
Pyramid.
Exactly. Less and less important.
And then you won't have to write us other letters saying, why is Alan editing my Google?
How dare you?
Yes, how dare you?
Page three said...
And Julia says, the baby elephant in the room is the Canal Corporation, which Andrew's father transferred to the Thruway and which toll payers have been supporting ever since. We actually said that.
Yes, Mike, Jules. And Judy and
we already said that.
Fine.
And then Tom says, Alan's view is, when the courts rule in favor of a liberal cause, it's justice and the system worked. When it's viewed as favoring a conservative cause, the courts are biased and Congress needs to act.
I think that's a very perceptive email.
Okay, there you go. And that, I think, is pretty much it.
Well, Russia could find itself shut out of track and field events at next year's Olympics in Rio. A report from a panel set up by the World Anti-Doping Agency accuses Russian athletes of widespread doping with the support of their government. Investigators concluded that Russian officials must have known about the doping and the cover-ups, and that even the country's intelligence service may have been involved. Russia denies it.
Well, now Russia is the great Satan now, right? I mean, America has decided that Russia is our, considering the fact that we don't have the old Soviets anymore, we just have the new Soviets, or whatever you want to call them,
right.
The new dictatorship. But, you know, it really does raise a question if the world bodies decide to cut Russia out because they've been cheating, whether you still have international competition.
Well, it also underscores the importance in the propaganda of a country to have a winning team in the Olympics and how important it is for Russia, apparently, if these allegations are true. They say, of course, that these are old allegations that have been already dismissed.
Complete nonsense, was the quote.
Yes, and they kind of diminish or dismiss the criticism.
The product of an inflamed imagination, which I think is nice. I think it's a nice turn of phrase.
And the head of their doping testing facility resigned earlier today. Already, so that there's some movement there. You know, it made me think of when you talk about competition in football, baseball, maybe we should just let everybody dope up as much as they want and professionals, you know, just give up the idea that we're going to have a fair game.
Well, then people would really be stupid.
They've weathered this before. East Germany, look at East Germany back in the Cold War. East Germany was terrible about this, and the Olympics still went on.
And I remember the time when U.S. athletes could only be amateurs. And
sure. Yeah, and the Russian team were professionals. It was the hockey. Oh, God, it was brutal. That's what made 1980 so wonderful.
But we won.
It was a great story. Now you have the dream team. They don't even do that well. The basketball team that has all the basketball stars on it, they don't even win.
So what do people who watch athletic events want? Do they really want?
They want another beer.
I'll answer that. I mean, you know, from my perspective, I want to see a fair match. I want to be inspired by somebody who doesn't rely on drugs, but who has used discipline to tone their body and, you know, jump the highest or jump the farthest or whatever the sport is, and, you know, run the mile under 3 minutes and 50 seconds and have it be a fair match, one person against another and not enhanced by drugs. But it's very difficult to police this, especially when the lab in Russia destroyed all the samples and had them retaken. You know?
And I think this is interesting. The interesting part of this to me is that they're claiming, the World Anti-Doping Agency's allegation is that agents of the FSB carried out surveillance of anti-doping work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
FSB being?
The old KGB.
Right.
Or I guess analogous to the FBI here. It's domestic, right? The FSB. And if they're doing that, that's just so 1970s.
Are you saying that Russia is corrupt?
This is great. Cold War. We'll start wearing the fur hats again. Good times.
Uh-huh. And is it just track and field at this point? Is that what we're
hearing? Soccer as well. And this affects FIFA. Let's see. FIFA weighed in on this. Do I have that quote? I don't have that quote. But FIFA.
They expressed outrage, which is
because
funny.
They're so squeaky clean over at FIFA. Yeah. All right. Well, that's enough of that. Shelley Silver's trial is going on. This is from the New York Times. and a piece by Benjamin Weiser and Suzanne Craig. On Monday, federal prosecutors in Silver's corruption trial turned to a relatively obscure staff member on the Assembly Ways and Means Committee, whose title seemed as bland as the job he held, Deputy Budget Director for Budget Studies, to open a window into the world of state finances that Mr. Silver controlled. Victor E. Franco is the man's name. He elaborated on the budgetary process as prosecutors sought to illustrate that Mr. Silver controlled it all with little transparency or accountability, particularly on the health department grants that are the focus of this case. You guys following this at all?
Yeah, yeah.
It's fascinating to see how much power Shelley Silver had as the speaker to direct funds and to have his staff basically erase his name from the spreadsheets.
From the spreadsheets. Yes. They would just, take that line out. Yeah. But is that a crime, though? That's the question.
Well, that was that his defense attorney did come back and do a cross-exam to say, as far as you know, was this against the law? And that's one of the big problems.
Oh, sure. That's the whole issue.
Yeah. Maybe it should be against the law.
Well,
maybe.
The one thing Pibrar has achieved here, as I've said before, is that he's opened it all up to public inspection. Right. And you see that the king sits there and says, no, yes, no, no, and yes.
Right, often with
you
little discussion.
You do a very good Shelley Silver, by the way, Alan.
That's what the New York Times said.
I'm Shelley Silver, yep.
That there was very little discussion. He would just, here are the proposals, yes, no, yes, 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 no. And
this is an example of what we political scientists call, Robert Michels did actually, a sociologist, the iron law of oligarchy. You may have a legislature with a lot of people sitting there, but one guy gets to go, no, yes, yes, and no.
Yeah, just think if you're an upstate Republican assemblyman, how much influence you have.
You have the power of warm spit.
Yes.
Well, the defense...
Or a Democrat, for that matter, upstate.
The defense in this case is trying to say, not exactly true. There was a lot of discussion among those who were involved on the staff. It wasn't just a yes-no situation.
No, but the interesting thing is, who got the yeses? And I think that that's where the prosecutor is going. So the yes goes to the guy who is sending people to the Silver law firm. Don't you see?
Yeah.
Right. And the question is it illegal for a powerful state legislator to send all this business to his own law firm and then get a bonus for getting those clients, high-paying clients for the law firm?
Well, he technically didn't send it to his own law firm.
Right.
But let's remember that it is the legislature that makes the laws. And they ain't making any laws that make it criminal to do what we're hearing about.
Well, who would stop them from making laws like this, Alan?
Themselves.
The average citizen who is looking at this and saying, that doesn't smell right to me. But we're not getting a lot of that from the average citizen.
Yeah. You could have every citizen in the state of New York writing a letter to the legislator and saying, this is disgraceful, and I still don't think they change it.
All right, that is where we will have to leave it. Mike Spain, Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok, thank you all very much.
Thank you
at home for listening and for writing roundtable at WAMC.org. Now, I know it's a tough mountain to climb, but there's actually another hour which might just be as good as this one.
Oh, it will be. Inevitably.
I suspect you're right. It's coming up next.